I sat down in front of him. I said, "Why are you homeless?" And he said, "2 weeks ago, my brother shot and killed himself. And it took me to the streets. And I realized at that moment that everything in my life made sense, that God had brought me to the place where he needed me to serve. And I've been there 17 years.
Welcome to Restorations. I'm Caitlin McKenney, and in Washington State, lawmakers are considering the passage of rent control legislation that would mandate a 7% cap on annual increases. The House of Representatives voted to pass this legislation, but not without significant pushback from Republican lawmakers and some Democrats as well. Here's Rep. Andrew Barkus having the last final word before the vote.
But Madam Speaker, how do we get here? Why do we have this problem? I can tell you, as somebody who's been a housing provider for 30 years, we have not always had this problem. This is a new problem for the state of Washington, and now we're trying to fix it with a policy that is going to make it absolutely worse. It is not going to provide stability. The only stability and predictability that we're going to have, Madam Speaker, is that I can guarantee you that tenants' rents are going to go up 7% every year, year over year. And that we will be back again, Madam Speaker, in another session to fix it yet again. We'll come back and look at this and say this is probably not the best thing. I'll tell you what the best thing. May I read, Madam Speaker?
Please proceed if it's relevant.
It's relevant. Thank you. Madam Speaker, I had this article. It says, Austin rents tumble 22% from peak of massive home building spree. Austin, Texas. Rents are going down 22%. You know why? Because they built 50,000 units in 2 years. How did they do that, Madam Speaker? May I read again?
Again, please proceed if it's relevant.
Texas Capitol has become the poster child for advocates who say the only way is by building more homes. And while other cities run progressive, including San Francisco and Chicago, and might I say, right here in Washington State, they face criticism because they're not focusing on what they should be doing. That's removing the barriers to creating more supply. Madam Speaker, please, I implore you, please vote with me no on this bill. Let's do better for the people of Washington State to great stability by creating supply, not another problem. Vote no.
So Representative Barkus does an excellent job here of saying there's actually something far more desirable to be pursuing than an unchanging 7% increase every year on rent, with all of the associated harms to housing supply that comes with that. And it's building enough housing that affordability increases on its own without this kind of radical government intervention. Austin, Texas is a great example of that. And while Rep. Barkus calls out some progressive left-leaning regions that have failed to allow or encourage increased development, it's worth noting that this is by no means a partisan issue. UCLA's Lewis Center for Regional Policy Studies did a 2025 review of 6 recent studies, 5 of which found that market rate development increases housing affordability across the income spectrum in the surrounding region. The University of Washington, again, not exactly a conservative institute, Center for Real Estate Research released a State of the States housing report in 2024. And in those 45 pages, we find that for renters, while the cost of rent has increased steadily over the last 10 years, the affordability of rent has remained very, very stable for both median and low-income renters. I think we should be really clear on this because people tend to confuse those things and assume that any increase in price means a decrease in affordability, but that's simply false. Take a look at this graph. It's not the most intuitive, but here we see that low-income households have almost 100% of the income necessary to spend no more than 30% of their income on rent, assuming average rental cost in Washington. Median income renters have around 140% of the income necessary to spend no more than 30% of their income on rent. The report indicates that very low income and extremely low income households lack the income needed to not be cost burdened by rent. So solutions targeted at this group will do far more good than slapping just a broad cap on rent increases across the board. The Washington State rent control bill flies in the face of both sets of research. One, by operating from a faulty premise that increases in rent mean decreases in affordability. This is not the case at median and low income levels. And two, by working against the proven reality that increased market rate supply is good for affordability. So kudos to Rep. Barkas and many others who have consistently spoken truth on this bill, and the fight will only continue as it moves through the Senate. Joining me today is Brian Chandler. Brian is the Director of External Affairs for Seattle's Union Gospel Mission and is working to connect policymakers, leaders, and advocates to make change on the issue of homelessness here in Seattle. Brian, welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll start by saying that at Discovery, we are big fans of UGM. We talk so much about this idea of treating the person as a whole person and not as just a body that belongs in a housing unit. And you guys, in my mind, are kind of the epitome of doing that work.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you start by sharing just a little bit about how you ended up at UGM and what UGM does?
Yeah. Well, we could probably take the whole time to share just that. I'll give you kind of the last part of my tour to Seattle's Union Gospel Mission. So I had a rough upbringing, and when I was about a junior in high school, I had some unforeseen circumstances happen in my life, and moved out of the house, lived on my own, finished high school on my own.
Was this in Washington?
This was actually in Kansas.
Okay.
During that time, after I graduated high school, I started drinking pretty heavy those last 2 years of my high school. I always say, you know, when I graduated high school, I went to Budweiser University because that's kind of the way that my path went. Got into some drugs, other things. Met my wife when I was a sophomore in high school. And from that, she had a very religious upbringing. I didn't, so I didn't come of faith until later in life. My alcoholism just took me to really bad places. And I was working three jobs to kind of feed my addiction. One of the jobs, though, I met a man named Andy Brown. Andy was a very strong Christian. Spoke to me about God all the time. I said some awful things to Andy. Did some awful things to Andy because I didn't want to hear anything about God. Because as far as I was concerned, he had abandoned me and didn't help me at all. Andy never gave up. He stayed right there. And he helped. He helped my family financially. He helped in some other ways that really drew my attention back to Andy to say, man, this guy really cares about me. Like, unbelievably cares about me. And he saw an opportunity for me to move away from my points of addiction, transfer me to Kansas City, Missouri. He had me live with him for 2 weeks while we were transferring my family. He said, I'll pay everything. I'll pay for your move personally. I'll do all of that on one condition, that you go to church. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I went to church and met some really cool guys, and Andy was still in my life. And eventually, on January 31st, 1993, I came to faith, and it just radically changed my life. Mm-hmm. At that point in my life, as I was growing a little bit into my faith, I prayed, and I said, God, I want to be Andy Brown the rest of my life. Like, I wanted to be that guy for other people, and committed it. And God saw fit to help me start working in a rescue mission and volunteering and doing meals. And so that was kind of my start in 1993, helping at City Union Mission in Kansas City. and from there held jobs that worked with the homeless. Moved to Seattle. I pastored for a number of years, moved to Seattle about 20 years ago, I think it was. I worked at Labor Ready. It's temporary service that helped many homeless people find jobs. But I felt like I needed to get back to ministry. Somebody mentioned Seattle's Union Gospel Mission. I looked up online, looked up a case manager's position, and I thought, gosh, this is everything in the ministry I wanted. And it had that component of Andy Brown in it. And I thought, wow. So I went on two interviews, went on the third interview and asked the inevitable question, how much does this pay? I had a family of three, and it paid, at that time, $21,000 a year. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's no way that we could do this. But my wife said, no, I think we need to, and saw God supply incredibly ways doing that. But one of the biggest ones is my brother. I got a call a week after I was at the mission, and it was my mom, and she told me to sit down. My brother, who was 2 years younger than me, was super close to, shot himself, killed himself, committed suicide. And it ruined me. It just ruined me. But Herb Fifter and other people called me. He's one of the CEOs of the mission at the time. And he said, you don't know me, and I hadn't met him. I'd only been there a week. But he said to me, he said, God pressed upon my heart to tell you not to give up. Mm. And it's exactly what I needed to hear. Went back to the mission about two weeks later. My office is full of flowers from Pike's Place, all the return flowers, you know, that they throw away. My office is full of them and cards and all this stuff. And I thought, man, this is true love right here. Mm. I sat down. Nobody was there to do a intake for a guy. And I didn't even know how to do it. They said, you're the only one here, dude. So you need to do it. And I said, okay. So I'm like, what do I ask this guy? So I sat down in front of him. I said, why are you homeless? And he said, he said, 2 weeks ago, my brother shot and killed himself. And it took me to the streets. And I realized at that moment that everything in my life made sense, that God had brought me to the place where he needed me to serve. And I've been there 17 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a powerful story.
Yeah, it's powerful.
I want to ask, because I think this is really cool and important to clarify. Andy Brown, is that his name?
Andy Brown.
He wasn't working at a mission.
Nope.
He was just a...
He was a business guy.
A coworker, a fellow... Yeah.
Right.
A colleague of yours who had this such a huge impact in your life just by doing what he was called to do. And wow, that's cool.
Absolutely.
That's cool, because I think sometimes we think that it has to be someone who's employed to do this job. And it's not. It can be all of our jobs.
Yeah, that's it should cool. be.
And so then you stepped into... director of outreach role, is that correct?
No, I started with this. I was a senior director of men's ministries. Okay. So I oversaw all of the men's ministries, search and rescue, legal, dental, for a number of years. And then it was through our partnership with Ed Murray at the time, who was the mayor in the city of Seattle, to help clean out the jungle at the time.
Okay.
That was around 2016 or 17, I think.
That's how the outreach role
Well, we were doing
started?
Search and rescue, but not at the level that we are now. So
can
we're doing
tell,
the evening.
Can you tell everyone a little bit about search
Yeah, so
and rescue.
Search and rescue is, we take our vans out every night, and this is kind of where it started. We took them out every night. It started when it was just 32 degrees and below and turned into this massive volunteer-driven. I had one staff, and we were sending out 5 to 6 vans a night, and it was all volunteer-driven and taken to the streets to work with people to help them get the help that they needed, to get them inside, to get them into our program, to help them to move forward in their life and to meet some of the immediate needs and basic needs right at that point. But what we realized was that you know, we'd make those promises at night, but guess what? Nothing's open at night. And so when we partnered with the city, there were four of us at the time that partnered to help do this, and we were doing it during the day. And then what we realized was, wow, we were getting people in left and right because everybody's open and everybody's willing to help. So during that tenure, Jeff Lilly stepped in his presidency, and he said, there's no way you can continue to be the senior director of men's ministries and do this outreach. So he said, you need to make a choice. I'm good either way. And I'm like, I didn't even pray about this. Like, outreach is where I want to be. And that's when we started our day routes. So now we do just as much during the day as we do at night, and it's a wraparound. So if somebody says we need help at night, then the morning crew go and follow back up and get them where they need to do and need to be and the help that they need. And then during the day, of course, we're getting people in, you know, fairly easy based upon how they desire, how much they desire to get the help.
Sure. So it could be into a UGM program.
It could. It could be.
Or to detox or to another program.
Yep. Another shelter, another program.
Yeah, I've done the nighttime search and rescue a few times.
Oh, good.
And it's really cool because you pull up in the van, you stop somewhere, and everyone knows.
Yeah.
Everyone who's experiencing homelessness in that area knows exactly who's there.
Yeah, it's so funny because, you know, most people that go, they're like, yeah, we pulled up to stop and we didn't see anybody. And like within 5 minutes, 40 people were at the back of the van.
Yeah.
And because they recognize that symbol as trust and help and support. So,
yeah,
we have a great relationship with folks.
It's clear. I want to take this opportunity to mention a report that I did in 2023 where I looked at the mobile outreach that you guys were doing and that Salvation Army is doing and compared it to a government-run outreach program that had just been started. And the results were very clear that you guys and Salvation Army, you know what you're doing and you're able to use less funding to have a far bigger impact in getting people moved inside. And so I think that speaks volumes to what you guys are capable of. So now, can you talk a little bit about your current role with Union Gospel Mission? There's been a lot of transition through your
There's been a ton of transitions. Scott Chen, who's our new CEO, about a couple years ago, just felt like we needed to really, you know, really push forward on how can we better help and better support, not just, you know, our vision and our mission is, you know, is to support the hours. In other words, you know, bring the people that are in Seattle and give them hope for a new life. And then the other part of it is that we want to see every homeless neighbor restored and redeemed. And so the focus point was on hours and every. And I got pinned with Scott Chen, a name for me as the Prince of Others. I was like, wow, all right, I'll put that in my new name tag. But it says volumes because it's like, how can we continue to help people get into programming and get the help that they need for addiction, get them into treatments, and then how can we help them move forward? Aftercare and some of those other things to really get moved forward into that and not to cause this kind of philosophy of, you know, just get them in and that's the point of entry and then they just kind of stick around. But what can we really do to provide the support and the help that's needed to really move them back into a stable life and to be a good community member and a tax-paying, hardworking Jesus follower that is dedicated in commitment not just to Christ but to the city and to do that, and how can we do that? And so we spent quite a few months, almost a year, I think, just talking about that. What's the difference between partnership and relationship? Because as you know, we don't receive any federal or government funding at all. It's all
so not from the city, not from the county, not from the state, not from the government.
Yeah. It all comes from amazing, amazing, amazing donors who just love our work and love to help and support, and we're so grateful for them. And so that's where my position came. And I wasn't looking to take this position. Matter of fact, when he offered it to me, I told him to go fly a kite. Like, I want to stay in outreach. I don't want to do this. And so he said to take a little while and pray about it. And I asked a whole bunch of people, and they all confirmed, oh, this would be great for you. And I'm like, no, I'm looking for one person just to say no. And nobody did. And so I took it, with just scared to death to take it. But when I focused mainly on relationship, God did the rest. And I didn't get caught up in anything else. It's just important for me to have a relationship, you know, with the council, as it is for me to have a relationship with Sam, who stays right down here. Mm-hmm. It was just important to me to meet those needs. And God has been using that in a great way, as you know, as well. And so that's what I do. I build relationships and try to do my best to communicate what's been effective for us and how we have been operating. And we made a lot of changes in the last 5 years, super effective changes. So being able to communicate, hey, this is what we're doing and this is what we're seeing. And here's the results. And of course, so many people are blown out of the water by saying, wow, this is crazy that you're seeing these results. And it's all by, you know, what God's doing. And I just get to be a little part of that and excited to do it. So this job still scares me, you know.
And you're acting as kind of a bridge between what you guys are doing at UGM and what the city, what the county is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and we're excited. And we're seeing some great results because of that. You know, I think that we get so caught up, and I think it was hard to move into the direction that we finally went to, because I think we just get so caught up thinking that everybody just knows, they just aren't making the decision. And what I realized was, people like myself and people in our mission and people all around who are informed of what is needed just aren't communicating at a level. Because I think that they feel, gosh, what do I know? I'm not a politician, or I'm not a, well, guess what? I'm not either. I don't have a, you know, science degree. I don't have a political science. I don't have any of that. I'm just a guy who loves what I do and loves to help people. And it's been amazing to see. So.
And what is that when you say that they don't know, or that they are, they know these things and they're not making
this decision,
yeah. But, and you're speaking into it. What is it that you are advocating for?
I think it's a number of things, but I think, you know, when you think about the housing and you think about addiction and you think about those things, I mean, ultimately it boils down to relationships. And, you know, people know many cases what it takes to get people help, whether they've had a family member that have went through it and it has succeeded. And they're like, gosh, I can tell you the path that my son took. I can tell you the path my granddaughter took. I can tell you the path. And yet, you know, they in many cases aren't hearing all of that part in how to approach and how to focus and how to, you know, what do you do as a parent? Those sort of things. And hearing the impact personally, that makes a bigger deal than, you know, they listen to empathy better, especially if you've been there. So, yeah.
It seems to me like there's been a shift politically and also just culturally, I think, in some of these big West Coast cities, Seattle being one of them, Portland, San Francisco, where things have just gotten so tragically bad. Homelessness, overdose deaths, that people are ready for a change and they're ready to do something different. If you could just wave a magic wand in Seattle from your huge experience here, your long time serving here, what would you want to see change in Seattle? And do you feel like that's on the horizon?
That's good. I'm glad you added that second part. It's like, how do I say? You know, I think changing the definition of success. For so many years, the definition of success was just to give somebody a key to a house. And we filled those houses. And people stay in those houses. And I have this text on my phone, and it's on my computer. And it says, hey, Brian, I want to go have sushi. Meaning, let's go to a place that sells sushi and I'll eat something else. And it's from Shelby. And Shelby died in one of the facilities over on Aurora Avenue. And that's what pushed me to say, we got to do more. That crushes me, but I take it personally too, because I think, gosh, what could I have done more? What could I have done differently? And say, And now I'm acting on those and saying, this is what I can do. And I can communicate that we need to change the definition of success. And I think, you know, when I was the senior director of men's ministry, I worked with the council. When I was in outreach, I worked with the council. And now in this position, I'm working with a new council. And I can say this, over all those years, my 17 years of being at the mission, we have one of the greatest councils that have ever been in my time, with the greatest focus and the greatest attention and the greatest understanding of what it takes. And it's so promising and so encouraging, and new leadership at King County Regional Homeless Authority and some directions that they're going. And you know, I had a conversation with one of them over there the other day, and she gets it. You know, it was about kind of housing plus, you know, what can we do inside of that housing to really help people move forward? And those are the questions that we need to answer, not just to give them a key. Does people need housing? Absolutely. We have graduates that need a place to live when they graduate a program. We have people that are in a LINC work program who need a place to live. And we need affordable housing, and we need it. But we also need support. They also need support. They need, in some cases, they need treatment. And how can we do that? And whether it's just inside of those environments, how can we partner together as agencies? You mentioned Salvation Army and us. And I think of a whole vast of others that see it the same way and are willing to do what it takes, you know, to support some of those efforts. And so being able to find those ways and to be able to communicate what we're seeing and continuing to see. So
it's encouraging to hear that you feel encouraged on that front. And I love what you said about the changing the definition of success from just we filled a housing unit and that's it to the whole person. They're flourishing, their ability to contribute to society,
absolutely,
their long-term health and safety and security, which I think brings me to my next question, which is you're not just involved at the local level, although that's where you're most rooted. This also has national implications because for a long time, the federal policy has defined success largely by, have we handed you keys to your fully subsidized permanent supportive housing unit? And so is there anything, again, if you could wave your magic wand, and we'll both be in DC with CityGate Network later, maybe by the time this is up, we will have already been there, but advocating at a national level for policy change, is there kind of a shift in direction nationally that you would like to see?
Yeah, you know, the same. What can we do to provide more treatment beds?
Yeah.
Also more push for behavioral health. And, you know, the behavioral health in our city and across the nation, and so many that are suffering and don't have a place and to go to see what can we do to better enhance opportunities for people to get in and more spaces and to provide the true help that somebody needs. And I've seen some of that already, you know, through King County, being able to provide some better support. But what can we do more? But the biggest one, too, is the treatment. You know, how can we truly help, whether it was addiction that got them to homelessness or addiction became part of that path of homelessness for them? The percent of those that are suffering from homelessness and addiction is pretty high. And being able to address that, whether it's inside of the housing, creating more treatment programs that are providing better all-around support for individuals. And, you know, we see it in our program with our aftercare program. We have a philosophy. We walk with you for life. And they can come back for services. They can come back. And by the way, we offer those same services to anybody, whether you've graduated our program or anybody else's program. You can, and whether you, you know, live in Seattle or California or wherever, we're going to provide that same because we believe that you can't do this on your own. And it isn't just why you're with us, but it's for life.
And I would assume while you're talking, I'm thinking about you talking about your men who are graduating from your program and they need affordable housing, they need a place to live.
Yep.
And I would assume that they need and want a place to live that doesn't put them back into, that doesn't
absolutely
surround them by the things that they just yeah. walked out of.
Yeah, and in the career path that, to go along with that, more second chance, more greater opportunities for people to get a career instead of just settling for something that isn't exactly, it's going to put them back in the same place. But what can we do to really get them educated and really get them on a path that can give them another chance to succeed?
Yeah. And to be self-sufficient, which I think most people absolutely. Want and desire for their lives. You know, they don't want to be dependent. They don't want to be addicted. They don't want to be doing nothing with
Yeah, I mean, people ask me all the time, how have you done this for 17 years? And it's the stories. It's the stories of just what you talked about, of how much dignity there is and confidence in somebody's life that has been through that path and is now self-sufficient and earning their own paycheck and providing for their families and starting families and so on and so forth. And that's what keeps me going, is knowing that that's taken place every day for us.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to my last question for you, which is, you've talked a lot about the role of faith in Christ in UGM's mission. What is it like for you to be a faith-based ministry in the heart of downtown Seattle? What does that mean to you and look like to you? Is it harder than you would have thought, or easier maybe than you would have thought?
And this is kind of part where I led to in the beginning of where I don't think Scott and I knew what God was going to do in this position. But over the last year to year and a half, faith has been one of the greatest components of individuals really wanting to hear more of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been an issue anymore. Mm-hmm. It's been, well, let's start listening to the faith communities. Mm-hmm. They're doing a great job, and they want to get involved, and they want to be a part, whether it's a church or a mission or another faith-based organization. They want to listen, and they're starting to pull us all together. And I've never seen that before. But it's happening now, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, our mayor and the city council and the direction that King County Regional Homeless Authority is going in that area. It's that we're starting to get to a place where Sam becomes our priority, not money, but Sam. And I believe that wholeheartedly in our government right now in Seattle and King County is that we're interested in really helping people. You know, they're becoming the reason why we do things and the decisions that we're making. And that's a great move forward, and it encourages my heart a lot too. So
yeah, that's exactly how it should be.
It should.
And I'm guessing that they can see the results in the people that are walking out of your program and see that, you know, maybe the spiritual component of what you're doing at Union Gospel Mission is actually a huge piece that might be missing.
Well, the greatest thing is I give tours. And when I give a tour of our facilities, especially our women and children, about 90% of the council members that have toured that said, this place is different. Mm-hmm. It's different. And we know why it's different. It's because of the faith component. It's because when somebody walks in, whether you're off the street or you're a council member or whoever you are, you're going to get loved. You're going to get cared for, because that's the heartbeat of everything that we do. And it's emulated all the way through our staff and our organization. And man, it brings me to tears every time I hear them say that. Because it's like, yes.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. That's
exactly what we're trying to do, is to see, you know, I tried for a number of years without Jesus and it didn't work. Mm. But when he came into my life, man, everything changed. It was crazy. And still does every day. I would love to sit here and tell you that I'm perfect, but Caitlin, I'm not perfect.
Neither am I. That's beautiful, Ryan. And your life is such a testament to that truth.
That.
And I believe that is truth. And so thank you to you and to your whole team at UGM for what you're doing, for seeing value inherent in every human being, especially on the streets of Seattle, and wanting to see them, like you said, restored and redeemed.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Restorations. I hope you gleaned some valuable information from my conversation with Brian Chandler. I'm so encouraged by the work that he and Seattle's Union Gospel Mission are doing to transform lives here in our city. Don't forget to follow or subscribe wherever you're watching or listening so that you don't miss the next episode of Restorations.